The force is really just inertia based on gravity. So the force all comes from the incredible warping of space-time of two enormous black holes. That's a lot of warping of space-time. And so I think it's just a consequence of that.
And as massive as those two objects were, and I think it was something like 1.3 billion light years away from us, that means that that event occurred 1.3 billion years ago, and that and the gravitational waves are now getting to us. And those gravitational waves created amount of strain. As those gravitational waves waved through the Earth, they created strain of everything in Earth, on Earth, and so on. And the amount of strain was something like a thousandth of the diameter. You take the diameter of a proton and 1,000th of that. It's the amount of strain. So the LIGO machine, I believe it can, I think its ultimate threshold in strain is 10 to the minus 23. And that event created something like 10 to the minus 18 or 10 to the minus 19. So it was well above threshold. But my goodness, is that something really small. In order for LIGO to do that, I got curious over the last week, and it was very hard for me to find, but I eventually found an article describing how LIGO works. I know that laser beams are waving back and forth in these 4-mile, nearly perfect vacuum tunnels with nearly perfect mirrors on each end of the tunnel. And the laser beam is flashing back and forth 140 round-trip times, the length of the 4-kilometer vacuum tunnel, one north-south and one east-west, so to speak. They're at right angles to each other. They're not exactly at those angles, but they're close. The signal had to go across those tunnels 288 times, and so each one of those times it's being stretched or shrunk. At the 288 transitions, then you measure whether or not it's very slightly out of phase, and we're probably talking about a millionth of a degree out of phase. That's as an interferometer. That's what
repeater timeout.
That's approximately what they were measuring, and it took them something like 5 or 10 years of continuous improvement of the LIGO hardware, better and better lasers, better and better vacuum in the tunnels, because a few molecules of air will deflect that beam and give you a false alarm. The mirrors themselves are 40 kilometers of perfect fused silicon, and the flatness of the mirrors are 20 times better than the mirror you've got on an optical telescope, 1 nanometer of flatness. And the silvering on the mirrors is so good that the reflection of the mirrors only loses 1 photon out of 3 million photons. That's extremely good silvering. And the mirrors are cryogenically cooled because you get a false alarm just from the thermal noise on the mirrors. And all kinds of improvements had to be made on the lasers to make a laser that pure in amplitude, phase, and frequency. And it maintains it during all of these transitions of their tunnels. That machine is beyond the state of the art. At the instant they committed, let me drop it. At the instant these guys from MIT, I think it's one of the main guys, Roy's going to tell me his name because I'm terrible at names. When they wrote this proposal to National Science Foundation, what they were proposing to do, had they known how difficult it was going to be, they would have been turned down. When it comes to the investment of the National Science Foundation, the LIGO machines were the biggest investment NSF has ever made. And it was an extremely high-risk investment with no guarantee of success. And for the first 10 years of testing, looking for gravitational waves, they didn't find any. They finally made the last massive improvement where they made the sensitivity 10 to 1 improved, turned it back on, and within roughly a week they made this discovery. So, what a story. AC2GS, K2LIW, I'm kind of amazed at that machine there, Roy.
A question about LIGO, Dick, to you.
Go ahead, Paul.
You're describing the mirrors and the light that's being generated. I know they go off at, like you said, roughly a 90-degree angle, or maybe exactly a 90-degree angle. But where, do you know where the light is being generated? Is it being
generator where it meets and where the mirrors are. The mirrors down at the end. At the opposite end, or is it the other way around? Is it being generated at the end, and where they meet, that's where the mirrors are at this 4 kilometer long tunnel. Livingston, I know, is one. I don't know the one in Washington. I forgot the name of that one. Back to you.
Yeah, that's the town I couldn't think of. Livingston, Louisiana. And all of a sudden, I forgot the name of the one in Washington. Nearly identical machines. There is an extremely flat 40-kilogram fused silica mirror on each end of each tunnel. So the north-south tunnel has one at the north end and the south end. The east-west tunnel has one at the east end and the west end. And the laser beam has to bounce back and forth, I'm guessing at a very slight angle, so that it walks across the mirror and traverses the mirror 140 times round trip, 288 trips back and forth. How the signal gets into that space between the two mirrors at each end of the 4 kilometer tunnel, that's not clear. Some of the pictures make it look like they somehow shine the laser beam directly through the back end of the mirror, and then it enters the... Is there a small hole in the mirror where the laser beam goes through? That I'm not sure about. How do you get the laser beam in there? I don't know. But I know that the majority of what the laser beam is doing is bouncing back and forth. It goes across the 4 kilometers 288 times, bouncing back and forth between each mirror at each end. After the 288th bounce, the mirrors are then brought back to a common point for the east-west tunnel and a common point for the north-south tunnel, a common point between the two, and those beams where they come, let me drop. They come to that common point prism, and those two beams are beat against each other exactly 180.0000 degrees out of phase. So they give you a perfect no. What's left over from that no is what the photo detector picks up as the resultant signal. It's a little bit like a Wheatstone bridge, but it's the optical equivalent. When everything is tuned perfectly, you get a perfect no. A gravitational wave coming along makes one of those 4 kilometer tunnels act like it's longer or shorter, alternately. And that's what disturbs the no, and all of a sudden the photo detector says, aha, I see something, and it quantizes that signal. And they're continuously quantizing that signal. This thing is making a terabyte of data every month or so. This thing is generating tremendous amounts of data that they have to sift through to find out, did anything happen? But how they get the laser beam in between the two mirrors is not clear, but it took me a long time to finally find an article that told me it bounces back and forth a total of 288 trips, 4 kilometers long, and that's a zillion miles. You can easily calculate that one. That was hard for me to find. The next step is, how do they get the signal to go in there in the first place? Does this give you a little bit more of a feeling for how that thing works, Paul? What a machine. And when they had been testing and looking for 10 solid years and didn't even get the slightest little squiggle of anything, well, they got lots and lots of signals. If somebody drives a truck across a road 10 miles away, it shakes the ground enough to disturb the mirrors. The way you mount those mirrors is a huge servo system that carefully measures all of the seismic waves in the vicinity of the mirror and pumps it back in as an out-of-phase signal, just like noise-canceling headphones. So they've got to do a tremendous amount of canceling of any possible motion of the mirror created by seismic waves, water crashing on the shore of a seaside create seismic waves that are way beyond the detectability of this machine. All of that's got to be cranked back out. So for 10 solid years, they were getting nothing but phony signals of Earth vibrations, if you know what I mean. And so during those 10 approximate years, I was getting very skeptical as to whether or not this idea was ever going to work. And I'm awful happy that it did, because as I said, it was the biggest investment National Science Foundation has ever made. It was rated as a very high-risk experiment, And thank goodness it worked, because other than that, National Science Foundation would be very reluctant to ever take on any high-risk experiments in the future. But the S2N, K2IIW, I wonder if you get a little bit more of a picture, Paul. Go ahead.
I've looked for information on just what you described, and I can't find anything. I've sat through a total of an hour or so of news conferences, and they'll talk about the tracks they're going by and what you described. But nobody talks about where this laser is, you know, where it starts, where is it generated. Okay, so we know it's going back and forth on the mirrors and probably, you know, traveling down the mirror as it goes. We just don't know where it actually starts. My guess, it starts at the apex, but we just don't know how it gets into the mirror. But that's a lot more than I knew when I started. Very good, Dick. Probably starts at the apex where the 90 degree is. They probably have all the equipment there. They probably have one set of mirrors down at the very end of each leg, and then, of course, more mirrors back at the apex to reflect back and forth. Okay, I do know from the news conference that it is shut down now. When they talked about this last discovery, it is shut down now, and I think it's going to be coming up even much more sensitive. They're going to incorporate 8 times the amount of space. So that should be good. Let me drop it. But if it's that much more sensitive, I mean, somebody's going to walk by and they're going to cough and the thing's going to go off. So they'll have to figure out, you know, what a false noise is and what a real one is. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the total amount of air that's in the 4-kilometer tunnels, the pair of 4-kilometer long tunnels, on one LIGO machine, at, say, for instance, Hanford, that's the one in Washington, and I've forgotten the one in Louisiana already, the 10,000 cubic meters of air had to be removed, and they got it down to 10 to the minus 9 torr. So it's an extremely small number of molecules left. 10 to the minus 9, I think, is the is either that's the ratio of air pressure versus what they got, or is it 10 to the minus 2. There's a 760 number in there, relates the two. So the amount of purity of vacuum required, the amount of purity of vibration required, the electronic equivalent of how each mirror hangs is on the equivalent of a 6-kilometer-long pendulum. It's not really a 6-kilometer-long pendulum. Electronically, they've created something that looks like a 6-kilometer-long pendulum. The actual laser that's shined into this machine is 400 watts of, I think it's 1054 nanometer laser light. The 400-watt laser did not occur in one step. There's a very high-accuracy laser generator that goes through 3 stages of laser amplification. Starts off at a couple of watts. I think it starts off at 4 watts, and then goes through 3 separate amplifiers to get it up to 400 watts, and each amplifier is supposed to increase the purity of amplitude and phase modulation. So it took beyond the state-of-the-art of lasers in frequency and amplitude stability, beyond the state-of-the-art of mirror accuracy and reflectivity, beyond the state-of-the-art of mirror mounting anti-shake, in other words, remove...
Repeater, timeout.
Removing all seismic vibrations on all of the hardware involved, cryogenically cooling the mirrors. As you can tell, these guys are pushing the state-of-the-art. They're beyond the edge of the art on every one of these concepts of each of the individual components to make this thing work. Reminds me of the saying that I've seen so often as a cartoon. The person who says it can't be done should get the hell out of the way of the guy that's doing it. So how these guys, for 10 years of negative results, had the faith to continue, how in the world they had the faith to go on, is just beyond me. So The accuracy of that laser is something you can't buy. The accuracy of those mirrors you can't buy. The accuracy of the way you mount the mirrors you can't buy. The cryogenic cooling of the mirrors is very unique. The design of the whole thing is unique. But as you probably know, the thinking of making a space-based equivalent, which can look for very lower, much lower frequencies of gravitational waves, and therefore you'll be able to see maybe the gravitational waves of planets going around stars. You know, it's a much smaller gravitational wave event compared to neutron stars coming together or black holes coming together. And one further point I'm going to make on this one. So two black holes coming together, as they coalesced, all the material of one, you could say, walked into the event horizon of the other, walked below the Schwarzschild radius, the event horizon. You know that all the light from inside of a black hole can't get out because the escape velocity is beyond the speed of light. So as they coalesce, black holes don't give you a big bang. Two neutron stars do give you a big bang. And they give you, there are a number of people who think that the big bang you got that you saw optically when those two neutron stars came together was possibly one of the major causes of inch for a gamma ray burst, what do they call it now? I can't even think of the combination of words they use. A gamma ray burst, when you see one, quite often has numbers like 10 to the 44 joules of energy. That's the total energy output of our sun in a 10 billion year lifetime. You take the total lifetime of the sun, 10 billion years, you gather all of the 10 to the 27 joules per second that it's putting out. Let me drop. The sun's going to last for 10 billion years. So you take the 10 to the 27 joules per second, gather them for 10 billion years, that's 10 to the 44 joules, a gamma ray burst, when you get one of those, you get that amount of energy, 10 billion years worth of energy, in roughly 1 second. These two neutron stars coming together came close to that amount of burst of energy across the whole down spectrum. Gamma ray, X-ray, ultraviolet, near and far ultraviolet, optical, infrared. It covered everything, a whole bunch of satellite, a whole bunch of telescopes. All looked in that direction when the LIGOs determined these last two neutron stars that came together. And the nice thing about the two neutron stars, when they come together, you get that chirping signal for 30 solid seconds. When two black holes come together, you get it for a third of a second. But those two neutron stars gave it to you for something like 30 seconds. Huge amount of energy. Over to you, Paul, for you were asking these questions on how LIGO works. This is some of the details. And see if this makes a little bit more sense, Paul. And we've still got a lot of stuff to find out how in the world that machine puts that laser beam in there. WS2N, K2LIW.
I could address that. Yeah, okay, let's go to Roy. Very well done, Dick. I tell you, you've looked into this. I thought I looked into it, but not enough. Back to you, and maybe over to Roy.
Yeah, whether or not we're talking about a space report now, because this is space hardware, space detecting hardware, space events. So we're mixing science and space and physics. Roy, how in the world did they get that signal in there? Tell us about that, Roy.
Well, in a word, they use a beam splitter. Let me see if I could explain this without illustrations and have it make any sense whatsoever. You have this long length going at a... You have these two things going at right angles to each other. And at some point, there is a partial mirror that lets some of the light get through, and at the far end is a perfect mirror that lets no light go through. It all gets reflected back. Now, you point both of those in 90 degrees apart from each other at a beam splitter, which splits half of the light goes straight through it. The other half gets reflected at a 90-degree angle. So it's injecting the signal into the one that's pointed directly in the same axis of it, and the 90-degree reflection is going to the 90-degree leg of it. And then both of them go back and forth between the reflectors They go through the same beam splitter, but since they're coming from a different direction, they are then sent at yet 90 degrees from all three of these devices into the photo detector.
I can see the beam splitter. You've got a 400-watt laser. You beam split it, and if the beam splitter was perfect, I'm going to use numbers here, 200 watts is going north-south, and 200 watts is going east-west. By some means that's not clear to Paul and I right now, you have to get that 200-watt signal on the north-south leg to end up between these two mirrors 4 kilometers apart at each end of the 4-kilometer tunnel, which are the most perfect mirrors mankind has ever made. They are 40 kilograms in weight, really perfect fused silica, 1 nanometer flat, perfectly silvered, so to speak, maybe it's gold, so that only one photon out of 3 million photons gets lost in each individual bounce. By some means, you have to launch the signal between the two mirrors 4 kilometers apart on the east-west tunnel, and the same thing on the north-south tunnel. By some means, you launch the signal between those two mirrors. The signal bounces back and forth 280 times, 4 kilometers long, 280 times, with only one photon per 3 million photons lost on each bounce on the mirrors. So the two mirrors that are 4 kilometers apart, they cannot be partially silvered. It ain't clear to me how the signal gets in between those two mirrors. One possible explanation is that you launch it into the sharp edge of one of the mirrors, and then at a very slight angle, and it walks across the two mirrors, bouncing back and forth, and comes out of the other edge after 288 bounces, 140 round trips.
Repeater, time out.
Maybe that's how it's done. How do you get the signal between the two mirrors? You've got an east-west cavity, so to speak, a highly tuned cavity east-west and a highly tuned cavity north-south. With this 1090 nanometer laser beam, 200 watts of it per leg, bouncing back and forth all of those times. How do you get that signal in between those two mirrors and keep it there? That's a darn good trick. So there's more to it than just the beam splitter as I see it. The beam splitter is where you do the splitting at the beginning of the laser beam, and there's another beam splitter where you bring it back together to get the null of the interferometry, which is the real detection. AC2GS, K2RIW, you got it right.
AC2GS. Well, supposedly the beauty of this, and it's an engineering feat, I'll give you that, I'll give it to all these guys. You use the same beam splitter for both operations, and one of the mirrors at the far end are completely mirrored, and the one closer to the beam splitter is 99.9% reflective, and that small amount gets past it into the beam splitter, which now, since it's traveling in the opposite direction, instead of splitting it to the other mirror array, it splits it off to the photo detector. So I think it's just a matter of one being, roughly 100% mirrored, and the other one being 99.9999% mirrored, where a small amount of transmission gets back into the beam splitter that gets sent off to the photo detector.
The high Q rod, so to speak, that's inside of an ordinary laser signal generator, does work by that means. The output end mirror is partially silvered, and some signal leaks out of it. But this thing, you've only got 400 watts of laser beam to work with. That partially silvered one, we're told that each mirror has a degree of reflectivity is 0.9999, a total of 9 nines, either 9 or 10 nines, is the reflectivity, 0.999999, if you know what I mean. If I started with 400 watts into that partially silvered mirror, would I get enough through the partially silvering? so that I could bounce it 280 times and still have enough signal to come back through the partially silvered mirror and have enough to detect. And one of their problems is that they need a lot of laser power to work this thing to make it run 4 kilometers 288 times and still have enough left over after the, let me drop it. After the beam spreading. And I'm beginning to believe you, Roy, because in order to have a beam that has that small amount of beam spreading, you have to start off with a very large aperture. I mean, the amount of wavelengths of aperture determines your beam width of the signal. They want the beam width of the signal going down that tunnel to be as close to collimated, as close to 0 degrees of divergence as they can get. So maybe the whole Dom mirror on one end is very, very slightly partially silvered. And you aim the whole... The mirrors, by the way, are roughly a meter in diameter. Yeah, I think they're almost a meter in diameter. And that's the only way you can get enough aperture to give you a small enough amount of divergence. So you might have it. We're going to dig a little bit deeper on this one. You might have it, Roy. AC2GS, KQRIW.
I found a diagram, WS2N.
Give us a few words on what you found in that diagram, Paul.
It's called the basic Michelson interferometer with 4 kilometers, Fabry Perot cavity. So, okay, so here's it. The diagram shows you where the laser starts, and it hits this mirror that's on a 45 degree tilt, like what Roy says. It's hitting this mirror that's, you know, some of it's going right through the mirror, and the other is being redirected 90 degrees from it. So now that travels out and goes all the way down, hits the mirror at the far end, and the other one that's split also hits the mirror at the far end. And now they come back and forth, and when they come back and forth, they're hitting this other mirror, and it's creating this cavity. And they go back. They don't show you going back hundreds of times, but they probably do what you said, Dick. And then when they finish doing that, they come right through that mirror. There must be some kind of, they don't show it, but there must be some way to get through part of that mirror. And then it comes out and reflects again off this one reflex, and then goes into another direction, picks up the detector. And I guess the two of them come back different, then there's a problem. But there is a diagram on it, their site.
Okay. After the beam splitter, when the signal is generated and hits the beam splitter, you have to get the signal to go in between the two mirrors 4 kilometers apart. How do they get the signal to get into that space? Does your diagram show that, Paul? Go ahead.
It's showing it as, you know, going right through it. I mean, it's it's not a physical, you know, it's almost like a flow diagram. It's going right through it. So they're not showing how it's going through it. The laser hits this one mirror that's on a 45, and that's translucent to one degree, and it goes through it, and the other one, you know, the other part of it reflects 90 degrees. So that's how they get them going in one direction, and they don't show you how to pass bypassing the first mirror to get caught in between this cavity. Who knows? Maybe it's just slightly below it, and they're at different angles. And like you said before, when it comes back, now it's trapped in a cavity. But we don't know that part. That's still a mystery.
Yeah, as I see it, let me drop it.
Comment?
There's two ways they can do it. Enter the signal at the edge of the mirror, and it zigzags back and forth with a very gentle angle. It walks across the mirror. After 288 bounces, it comes out the other end of the mirror. That's one approach. The other approach is to go directly through a partially silvered mirror. And they need 400 watts of signal because that very first mirror it goes through is giving them so much loss. That's a guess. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, the basic Michelson interferometer is not as nice as LIGO's. It's not as sensitive, so it doesn't have a second set of mirrors at the other end. It's simply one mirror at the end. It bounces back, and it's a relatively simple concept. A beam splitter is half silvered. Half of the energy is transmitted through it. Half is reflected. And since it's tilted at a 45-degree angle, it tilts the reflected light at a 90-degree angle. And depending upon, the laser goes through the beam splitter to one mirror, gets reflected at a 90-degree to the other mirror, then both of those go back through the same beam splitter. One of the beam splitters transmitted straight into the photodetector. The other one, again, reflects it at 90 degrees, but then it's at the beam splitter. So beam splitters are not terribly esoteric, although I'm sure the optical tolerances of this design were amazing.
The classic Michelson interferometer, the classic interferometer you're describing, where the signal has to only go down to the far mirror and bounce once, and come back to the beam splitter. That's easy to understand. If you want the signal to go down and bounce back and forth a total of 280 times, and then exit the pair of mirrors on each arm, and come back to the beam splitter, that's a lot more difficult. And I'm guessing now the partial silvering of that mirror is the reason why 400 watts is required. At first I thought 400 watts of laser power is required because they're going through, 1,500 miles of total path length. 4 miles long, 288 times, we can calculate that. it's probably 150,000 miles, some crazy number. And so to have enough laser left over after all those miles is why I thought they needed 400 watts. Maybe they need 400 watts because only a lot of it gets through the first partially silvered mirror. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Great. It's a relatively lossy design, unfortunately, that requires that much power. I mean, at the beam splitter alone, you've gotten 3 decibel of loss right off. And then you have to deal with the loss because no mirror is completely perfect. And you silver the far end more than you silver the one that's closer to the beam splitter, with the idea that on a probability, once every 300 trips back and forth, it'll just skirt the silver particles and go through and act as a transmission. So, you're going to get attenuation there. So I would assume that it's built for all this attenuation. That's what makes it finally work in the end, that and the tolerances.
It's one hell of a machine. And now, when it comes to the kind of astronomy that we've all been discussing on the space report for 275 times, the space report, there's astronomy for radio, microwave, millimeter wave, far infrared, near infrared, optical, ultraviolet, X-ray, gamma ray. So you got that whole spectrum of what we used to call DC to light. Where does gravity fall on that? Much closer to DC. We're talking about numbers down at 30 hertz and doing some real gravity wave detection at 30 hertz. It's getting close to DC, but it's a very different phenomenon. Let me drop this. All the theory seems to say that a gravitational wave transports itself at roughly 300 million meters per second. 3 × 10⁸ meters per second. The speed of light. Gravity travels at the speed of light. Is gravity an electromagnetic wave? Darn interesting question. Because electromagnetic waves, up till now, we can when it comes to radio type and optical type electromagnetic waves, we can easily detect them and transmit them, generate them. We've never generated a gravity wave, to my knowledge, in reality. Or you could make a great big wheel on a shaft with heavy weights on the perimeter of the wheel, and you wave those weights near something. And so, to a very small degree, that near something is going to detect a pulses of gravity, so to speak. But you didn't generate those gravity waves. You used chunks of mass to do the generation for you. So, is a gravity wave an electromagnetic wave? I think Einstein used to think so. He thought he would solve that equation, and I don't think he succeeded on that one. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Okay, now we're getting very esoteric. I don't believe that gravity is electromagnetic waves. There are four, to my knowledge, fundamental forces in the universe. In order of strength, the strong nuclear force, the electromagnetic force, the weak nuclear force, and gravity. Gravitational waves are a phenomena of gravity, not electromagnetism. And one of the things is that black holes hold on to light, but they're unaffected by gravity. There are particles that are unaffected by electromagnetism. Uncharged particles don't react to electromagnetic fields. In the same way that gravitational fields run right through black holes, and that's why we're able to see them. Otherwise, they'd be swallowed up along with everything else in the black hole collision.
Yeah, that's really crazy. A gravitational wave seems to travel at the speed of light. Light travels at the speed of light. Light cannot exit black hole, but gravity waves can. Can you imagine if a gravitational wave could not exit a black hole? You'd have no way of knowing it's there until you walked into it. As it is now, you know that that black hole is there. If you're anywhere near it, you will sense the fact that it's making a huge gravitational field. Or you can watch light being bent beyond it, that's on the far side, so to speak. You can watch things in orbit around it, like we can watch solar masses at the center of our galaxy moving in very strange ways. They're occasionally whipping around some very heavy point source object that has not yet ever been directly seen. Back to you for any comments on all of the above, Roy. AC2GS, K2LIW. You think we're ever going to understand gravity?
I don't know. I certainly hope so. I think what Einstein was going at was that it wasn't even a force. It was simply a distortion of space-time itself, which is an interesting way of looking upon things. You usually see that on YouTube, is someone taking a piece of elastic sheet and throwing a bowling ball, and it has it, as it distorts the contours, things are drawn towards it the same way that gravitational forces. But the problem with anything that's a force carrier is force carriers cannot be affected by the forces that they carry. Otherwise, everything breaks down. And so if you had a black hole that held on to gravitational waves, there would be no gravitational forces causing anything to go into the black hole. So it would be this weird thing that would not show up on anything if you just happened to, on your own power, traveled past the event horizon. You'd never be seen again, but otherwise there would be nothing else going on. You wouldn't see all this kind of commotion about the black holes circling and diving into each other with collisions and gravitational waves. So it would be a much stranger object if gravitational waves could be captured by black holes themselves.
There's one other way of looking at this, as I see it, Roy. The black hole has to have gravitational waves that it radiates. That's the only way it can gather material. A black hole is a very massive object that has gathered a whole lot of mass. It has accreted a whole lot of mass. I mean, for all we know, there were a million events that added mass to the thing that you and I call a black hole. those million chunks of mass can only be added if it's radiating some very strong gravitational waves that suck the stuff in, so to speak. So if it didn't radiate gravity waves, it could never be built up in the first place. It could never get heavy in the first place. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's got to radiate gravity, otherwise it can never get big. And the biggest black holes, I think they found a pair of them in two separate galaxies, or at least one galaxy has one that is 18 billion solar masses. That's heavy. AC2CS, K2LAW.
Once again, you can have a lot of problems with semantics. Gravitational waves are not the same as gravity. Gravity, think of sort of gravity as DC current and gravitational waves, I guess, is RF. Fluctuations in a gravitational field produce gravitational waves, and that's why you need violent things like neutrons or black holes circling each other to produce them. Otherwise, they don't produce fluctuations in gravity and aren't picked up that way. So there's a difference between a gravitational field or gravitational attraction and a gravitational wave.
Yeah, I like your analogy of DC versus AC. So the main thing a stable, non-spinning black hole is doing is it's radiating gravity, a steady-state gravity, a continuous suck, so to speak. Now, when you get a pair of objects, neutron stars, black holes, white dwarfs, whatever, circling each other, when they are aligned to you, you see one amount of gravity. When they're at right angles to you, you see a slightly different amount of gravity. And so, therefore, on each rotation, you're going to see two peaks and two valleys, or is it four peaks and four valleys? Let me think. Two peaks and two valleys on each rotation of the gravitational waves. You could say each 360-degree rotation creates two cycles of the gravity wave, is what I believe is going on here. And by the way, it has polarity, as you'll notice, because your two objects going around each other, they could be going around in the plane of your consideration, parallel to your horizon, so to speak, or perpendicular to your horizon, or a whole bunch of angles in between. So there's a polarization to a gravitational wave. Have I got that one right, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW?
What's happening is space-time in some points are contracting and other places expanding. So, you know, if you want to say that contracting is one phase and expanding is the other, that's fine. And as far as black holes, most black holes actually have a internal angular momentum. They have a spin. Very few have no spin, although they can exist. But the spin is incidental in itself. And again, Einstein would rather say, rather than giving off gravitational radiation, he would tend to look upon it as the mass distorting local space-time. You know, six of one, half a dozen of the other.
We got to be careful with the words we use. Got to get the words right. I agree with you. Okay. Either your choice, Roy, to carry this one further, or to discuss your other subject that was brought to your attention for the physics section. See now, do we call it the physics talk? Physics talk or physics talk? Or some other name? Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
As I wrote you, I would prefer physics with an S rather than physic without the S, because to some people, a physic is a purgative, and I would hate to have people think that anyone is vomiting up physics. So I would say physics talk with an S in the middle, if that's possible. But we can go on to the next one, because it might be a short one. It, you know, depends upon whether it leads to anything else, but it's a relatively simple question that was asked.
Fire away, sir.
Okay, the gentleman asks, what is the accumulated radiation from the airport X-ray that's going on for so-called security? People who fly weekly are in danger, Okay, that was just a thank you. Okay, so that's the question.
Do we have anyone within our listening audience that has any words on that subject? So the TSA, Transportation Security Agency, at many airports, uses a kind of an X-ray-like machine, particularly on your luggage. They X-ray your luggage. And I think in some cases they actually use something like an X-ray. In other cases they use thermal sensing. There's all kinds of ways they can find out whether or not you've got a hidden weapon below your clothing without forcing you to remove your clothing. So what's the most popular way of TSA doing their work, Roy? I think they've got a number of different techniques depending on which airport and which country. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Well, it's my understanding it kind of breaks down into three things. They have metal detectors, which is really old tech. They have backscatter X-ray devices, which I think this gentleman is referring to. And then they have millimeter scanners, which are microwave generators. They're non-ionizing radiation. But that seems to be the three major detection methods as of this year.
Now, there is a fourth technique that I have seen a working model of. When I say seen, I mean I have seen photographs of it. I've seen photographs of what it displays. It is a passive thermal imager running at 108 gigahertz, or is it 98 gigahertz? Anyhow, there's a designated frequency region where if you can build a sensitive enough receiver as a phased array receiver, this consists of a whole lot of, let's call them a whole lot of millimeter wave dipoles spread across a flat sheet that's got the X and Y dimension to it. There's hundreds of these individual millimeter wave dipoles. Each one has a completely separate, the equivalent of a completely separate passive thermal imaging receiver. To repeat what I told you guys, what I did when I was building that 12-foot diameter dish to listen to the Apollo astronauts at 2.8 gigahertz in 1971. Let me drop. That was Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 that I listened to while they're in orbit around the moon and on the moon. When I finally made a really good low-noise parametric amplifier into a very good feed horn at the focus of this 12-foot diameter homebrew dish, that receiver was such a sensitive radiometer that when I looked at the S-meter on that receiver and I stood on a wooden chair in front of that dish and then I had to put my hands up on that feed horn to move it to peak its focal point, the thermal energy at 2.8 gigs coming off my body would peg the signal strength meter on that radiometer receiver. That was passive thermal imaging. It was at 2.8 gigs, and that was a 3-degree beamwidth. You'd like to have a milli-degree beamwidth in order to really resolve all the objects that could be hidden under the clothing of a human being. So, in theory, I have seen a working model. I have seen pictures, and I've seen the results. I've seen a computer display, a thermal imaging receiver that can do that. Very expensive. Very difficult. Therefore, for the time being, it hasn't caught on. When the integrated circuit chips running at 96 gigahertz get cheap enough, that thermal passive imaging technique, which doesn't irradiate the human being at all, it uses your radiation flashing through your clothing that gets blocked by that gun, whether the gun's made out of ceramic or made out of metal, that's under your clothing. Now, that's a very good technique when it becomes cheap enough. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Well, in addition, they were working on a terahertz scanner. I mean, technology continues because if you come up with a price reasonable design, you could crank out, thousands and thousands of these things. There are warehouses full of tried, tested, and failed technology that was replaced with other failed technology. But I think this guy's question strikes me as kind of concerning how much backscatter X-ray he can take before he glows in the dark.
Okay. When it comes to backscatter techniques, does it have to be X-ray? Couldn't it also be active millimeter wave? I could aim a millimeter wave signal at you, and then with the right kind of a scanning sensitive millimeter wave receiver, I could make a picture of you on the millimeter waves reflecting off of you. So it doesn't have to be X-rays. X-rays tend to be ionizing. I can do that with non-ionizing radiation, Roy. AC2GS, K2IW.
AC2GS. Yes, that you can, and in fact, many places do. There are a lot of microwave devices that do exactly that with non-ionizing radiation. I'm just going back to this guy's question because he seems to be focusing on the backscatter X-ray, and there are some airports that don't use microwave for some odd reason. I guess they ran out of money, and the last machine they bought was a backscatter X-ray machine.
Right now, I don't know which is more expensive and which gives you higher resolution. Because of the wavelengths involved, I suspect you can get higher resolution out of X-ray. But the X-ray you got to be careful with because it is ionizing. And now we're going to ask ourselves the question, is the amount of X-ray exposure I get from the TSA at this particular airport, which might be, let me pick a number, Baltimore. If I go to the Baltimore airport, and I don't know what they've got, but if I go to the Baltimore airport and I happen to be using a backscatter X-ray machine, am I getting one-tenth equal or 10 times the amount of X-rays I get with a dental X-ray? Most of us have come to accept a dental X-ray as long as it's only done once per year. But if I've got to travel through the Baltimore airport every single day, then I think I would start to worry. AC2GS, K2LAW.
WS2N, don't they measure that in servits, Roy?
Yeah, there's a zillion different kinds of units, sieverts. There's a zillion different kinds of units. It's the magnitude that we're concerned about and how often it occurs. Over to you, Roy.
Yes, one of the units is a sievert, and the manufacturers of backscatter X-ray machines swear up and down that an average scan takes one microsievert exposure, which is approximately the same amount of radiation you get from eating a normal-sized banana. It has radioactive potassium in it.
I heard somebody say he's got a comment. Please give me a full set of call letters, a name, and then tell us your comment or question, sir. Go ahead.
Good evening, Dick. This is KC2SHO, John, in Los Alamos. One thing they always push here at the Los Alamos Labs is in the training is the amount of ionizing radiation that a typical airline worker gets can be even much higher than what a typical rad worker might get. So if they're so concerned about ionizing radiation, are they aware of the ionizing radiation they're receiving at 30,000 feet, and how does that play into the equation? Back to you, Dick, KC2SHO.
That's a very good comment, John. There is a beautiful YouTube video by Derek Mueller. Derek Mueller is the guy who makes this set of science YouTube videos called Veritasium. And if you see the one that he's done where he bought a fairly high-quality radiation detector, he took it on an airliner and measured the amount of radiation you get from a banana, from 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, and 40,000 foot altitude for an airline, a person in an airline. He went to Fukushima in Japan. He went to the Los Alamos testing site. He went to the place where they built the first A-bomb. And he also went to the Russian site where they had the event. I can't think of the name of the town all of a sudden. He went and made measurements at all these places. And after he made the measurements in all those places, quantified them, he went to Hiroshima, he went to Fukushima, he went to the place in the Ukraine where the Russian event that took place of the nuclear power station that blew up in 1985. Let me drop it.
Chernobyl, Dick.
That's the name I was looking for. Let me let it beep. I sometimes hear it pronounced Chernobyl, but Chernobyl is the way we usually pronounce it. He went to all these places, and he made the measurements. You'll never guess where he found the maximum radiation exposure. I'm going to pass it back to you, John, to give us a guess. I'm then going to pass it over to Roy, and then I'm going to pass it over to Paul. And maybe one of you guys have heard me talk about this once before, in which case you should disqualify yourself. But where do you think, John, he found the maximum radiation that a human being can be exposed to? AC2SHO. KC2SHO. K2RIW. You got it, John.
Well, I can only deduce that you're going to tell me it was at 30 or 40,000 feet. So that's my guess. I forget who gets it next, but that's my guess, and I'm sticking with it. K2RW, KC2SHO.
John, that's a very good guess. He found something orders of magnitude higher than that. Roy, do you have a guess? AC2GS, K2RIW?
Unfortunately, I know the answer because I subscribe to him. It's a very good series of YouTube.
And I'm going to disqualify Paul because Paul has heard me talk about this once before. And you working at Los Alamos know full well, John, that the amount of nuclear exposure, the amount of radiation exposure a human being gets, is a function of two or three factors. Number one, how strong is the source? Three factors. How strong is the source? Number two, how close are you to the source? Number three, how long is the exposure? Okay, there is an exposure that a high percentage of the human race exposes themselves to that's a very, very low magnitude source. But the source could not be any closer, and the duration could not be any longer. It turns out that tobacco is a mildly radioactive substance. Let me drop it. A cigarette smoker is depositing tobacco particles on his lung. Although the particles are very low in their amount of radiation, so the source is weak, but the source is close. It is laying directly on the cells of your lung. It cannot get any closer. The exposure is tremendously long. Those particles are there for years, particularly in view of the fact that even if you cough them up, the next time you smoke a cigarette, you're replacing those particles. A cigarette smoker is exposed to, I forget how many thousands of times greater radiation exposure compared to that maximum altitude airline pilot. At first, I thought that was very surprising. When you start getting into the specifics of magnitude, duration, and distance, it suddenly makes some sense. AC2SHO for any comment. I wonder if that's a surprise to you. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RW, KC2SHO. I do remember you saying that now in a previous net. It's all coming back to me. So not surprised so much at the fact, but surprised I didn't remember. But that is very interesting. And yes, there are things all around us all the time. I think we talked about it before, if you remember, Siestaware was an alpha emitter. And people were eating food off of that. Like you said, bananas. Geez, I eat one just about every morning. I need that potassium where I get those nasty leg cramps at night, you know. But very interesting. And no real other comments, but... Here in this area, of course, it's a hot topic, so there's a constant chatter about it. K2RIW, thanks a lot. KC2SHO.
What's amazing about cigarette smoke is that we're slowly, after decades, finally admitting, society is admitting, that there's a drastic increase in the probability of getting lung cancer if you're a smoker. And we used to think it was the effect of nicotine and other chemistry. I mean, you take tobacco smoke, you take tobacco and burn it. You generate something like 1,000 recognizable biologic products in that cigarette.